Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Print Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Michael Morris. Let's get into our first news story of today, and we're going to be speaking a little bit about yesterday's big story, which is the unemployment numbers. But this is focusing on a specific test case, and it's this article caught both of our eyes while we were looking for stories today. The title is Google to Gold Rush. Zama Zama say they will not stop until government creates jobs. The story goes on to talk about some Zama Zamas and residents of the Google to informal settlement in the East Rand continue to process gold in broad daylight, even after cops from the Irukurraleni Metro Police Department showed up and told them to stop. As soon as the officers, some of them continued processing gold, the officers appeared to have just sort of stood around and looked at them and observed their processing facilities and then left. And the Zama Zama said you returned to work once the cops had left. The Zama Zama said that a gram of gold they could sell for between 1,500 to 1,800 rand, with the miners working in groups of 5 and 8 and sharing the profits amongst them. A man named Fana Mageba said, "We don't fear the police. We are unemployed and survive from illegal mining. EMPD officers are aware of what we're doing. They can't act as if we don't know." Mr. Mageba here said that he believed that every home in the informal settlement nearby was involved in illegal mining in some way, was occupied by an illegal miner. He said, "I recently started illegal mining. Yesterday alone, I made 2,500 rand. Life is tough here. We are not going to stop until the government offers us jobs." Another miner, a guy called Tumele Motlong, said that illegal mining was the only way he could support his unemployed wife and 3 children. He said the soil in the informal settlement was rich in gold and didn't even require a lot of digging to get gold pieces out of it. He said, "We live and walk on top of gold. The soil is rich with gold. We don't dig deep to find the precious metal. Just a knee-deep hole can change your life." He said he started illegal mining in 2017 after losing his job. He also told the journalists, "We don't work. We are unemployable. There are no odd jobs here. We can't be criminals or rob our neighbors. They will kill us if we become criminals." He said him and 6 of the men who worked with him had recently produced 18 grams of gold. Another miner told the journalists there that gold buyers arrived every evening, so they didn't even have to travel and transport the gold far away. They say that the practice is also very lucrative because local women from the area have become involved and they've taught them how to process gold. A woman who owns some of the land around there, who's a cattle farmer, Tombin Gajimi, said that she had rented out bits of her property to these miners in exchange for 20 or 50 rand to dig holes on the space she owned. But they stopped paying and they just left the place riddled with holes. They didn't fill them back up once they finished digging. So she said she's going to source an excavator to just fill them all. She said she would have joined them herself if she knew how to process gold. So, Michael, this is an interesting sort of microcosm of the situation I think many South Africans find themselves in, which is just sort of trying to get scratch a living out of whatever they can. This is better than most Zama Zama operations, which involve going down into these disused mine shafts, which are absolute nightmarish hell worlds where, you know, there's often inter-gang clashes and stuff underground. It's very nasty. It's hot. People die in mine collapses. This is just, you know, scraping up surface deposits, which is quite amazing that people are able to make a living off of this, and in fact such a good living in some cases. You know, this guy saying he got 2,500 rand in a single day. But also, you know, I think when they say we will stop only if we're given jobs, I mean, firstly, there's a sort of strangely extortionate aspect to that from one of the guys working here. But also, I think there's a little bit of mistruth there. There's very few jobs you can get where you're going to make 2,500 rand a day if you are, you know, currently unemployed. So I think some of this, like, you know, once an illegal operation starts and people get into breaking the law and kind of going outside the bounds of society, and they get involved in a community and an industry. People believe that. Still, the point stands. You know, if you are living in an informal settlement and the only source of revenue that anyone around you has is the 350 rand a month social relief of distress grant, or, you know, the couple hundred for child grant or whatever, digging in the dirt, maybe fending off people, doing something illegal, seems like a pretty good option. What's your take on this whole story?
Yeah, I mean, that immediate appeal is such a human one. I mean, every gold rush in history has been, you know, a response to much the same kind of thing. We were chatting earlier, about the sort of wider implications of this. And my initial sort of thought was what we're looking at in a sense is a collapse of a social contract. But that's a little bit too vague and a little bit, you know, I don't think it defines it really enough. And in our discussions, I think we took it closer to what really is meaningful, and that is this very simple thing. We see it in that very powerful quote from that chap, you know, saying we'll stop if only the government gives us jobs. One is left with this very crisp impression of the consequence of the government's long insistence on having a meddlesome and overbearing presence, not only in society but in the economy, in the way we work or don't work, where and how we set up businesses, who we have as partners, every little sort of detail that is written into regulations, and we see this sort of particularly acute during the COVID period, where we saw, you know, all this absolutely absurd micromanagement of things. But we see it in all our legislation. This really overbearing presence of the state, as if the state feels the same. It's fine. I think I might have disappeared there for a moment.
Yep,
so we have the sense of, you know, a state that really does believe it has a primary role in our lives, in our society, in the economy, directing how things should function. And the ironic penalty of this is that, you know, people really do expect as a matter of habit that the state is there to provide, to give jobs. One couldn't think of a more disempowering state of affairs than exactly this. And the worst of it is that it comes at the very moment when the state is least able to respond with any meaningful material, in any meaningful material way, of it providing jobs, increasing grants. You know, the money is running out. The taxes are under pressure. The fisc is under pressure. It's just not a good time for people to think that they can sit back and not indulge in irregular activity of one kind or another, but instead go to the state and be satisfied with a good job, and meaningful employment, I think, is the phrase that one so often hears. And so it's this really quite, as I say, disempowering state of affairs. But the problem is the sort of social condition is one in which there is an expectation that people don't really have agency within agreed forms. The other issue, of course, that is raised by the story is to what extent should there be regulation? We see here a sort of cowboy capitalism where people just doing acting freely, and as an organization that rates freedom very highly, these are testing questions. Quite clearly, there needs to be some kind of agreement between society and government as to what is feasible in the economic space or in the environment. Can you dig holes all over the place? Whose land is it? And so on. Right. It is a complex subject. But if all of that just erodes away, because the state is now incapable of meeting the promise that it implicitly makes in every step it takes, you then have the kind of problem that we see. And people saying, you know, well, we're not going to indulge in criminality because the neighborhood will kill us. But nevertheless, we are going to carry on being Zamas, whatever the police say, until the government gives us jobs. You know, so it's quite a nihilistic environment that is, I think, traceable yes. back to the very basis on which we were building. Not we necessarily, but our government has been building this post-1994 democratic state. It's quite an ironic thing.
It's also sort of an interesting slap in the face to government's custodianship of all the minerals, right? You mentioned this when you say that we should question the sort of regulations here. I mean, in a certain sense, this is just a unsafe mining operation. I'm sure the gold processing part is probably involving very dangerous chemicals. I know that quite often these Zama gold processing operations they poison people by mistake, the horrible things happen because they're using all these toxic chemicals. I think they often use arsenic as part of the process to separate the gold. I'm not a geologist, so I wouldn't. this is not my area of expertise, or a chemist. So, there are definitely some costs here, but at the same time, why, if you do have all those prerequisites that you might potentially get, for example, the right to actually dig on a piece of property, the sort of safety stuff, not poisoning people, that kind of thing, would there actually be anything really wrong with this? This is just people trying to make a living off of work, which is, a thing we actually want in South Africa. That's, the kind of the goal. And yet the state has this vision of sort of managing everything and the micromanaging, and then the police arrive. But despite all these pretensions of being the sort of vast overreaching force into our lives and, controlling all the minerals and controlling where people work and all this, the state has so little capacity that the police arrive and it's like, oh, well. Some of the in the reporting here, most of the miners ran away when the cops came. They didn't run very far. They were just sort of a few hundred meters away, kind of watching curiously. Some of the Zamas apparently didn't even move. They just kept working, which I think shows the complete sort of just complete disintegration of the state's authority in a very real way. And, this mining operation is not as awful as many of the Zamas ones, as I mentioned at the beginning, which are often far more intense. This one is at least surface mineral stuff. But, I suspect there is an organized crime element operating here very strongly. It's very difficult when you have the complete absence of law and order and the police and that sort of thing to stop, criminal element moving in. And I'm sure that's not making things any easier. But this all kind of goes back to the situation, the sort of, as you say, the nihilistic condition we are left in, or so many people are left in, because there really aren't that many opportunities to do things the right way. The right way would presumably be getting a proper regular standing job or starting your own business or something like that. But red tape, taxes, bad infrastructure, overly restricted labor laws, et cetera, mean that people have to look for alternatives. And in some cases, the alternatives are this. If you try to go legal, you get smothered, so you might as well be illegal.
That sums it up perfectly. Is that people are, making really quite rational choices here. Even though those figures, 1,500 or 2,800 or whatever it was a day, I'm sure that's not every day. And
it's often divided between a bunch of people, right?
Lots of people in town. And it's very likely that, if you had a proper mining operation, people being employed there would be getting not just, a steady salary, but all the other things that go with it. It's just a completely different kettle of fish. At the same time, the mining law is so onerous just the environmental conditions, you know, compared to what's going on here, and what, you know, what the landscape is going to look like once the Zama-Zamas move off and move on to the next spot. And you know, you have this complete mismatch between what the government, you know, the action the government is prepared to take, or the position it takes on legitimate mining operations, and making it very, very hard for people to invest and, you know, do all the massive economic activity that flows from a big investment in a mine, and the length of time also that that investment is that, and it's fixed investment too, that, you know, that it produces good things for the society. Huge effort made to constrain that, and yet complete ineffectiveness in dealing with the Zama-Zama situation. So there are these terrible ironies, and you're mentioning, you know, the institutional integrity is so important. Once you lose that, everything else just begins to erode away. If people don't actually respect policing, and unfortunately we've seen from lots of polling, not only our own but the Afrobarometer and others, that, you know, the levels of trust in policing in South Africa are very low. That has consequences, and it's literally in society just not bothering to abide by the law. That's what it comes down to. And feeling that they can get away with things just as they see senior politicians getting away with things. It all kind of filters down, and it has this effect. So it is, it's a wonderful microcosm of exactly what we need to confront in South Africa.
You know, In the sort of pre-modern era, when people talked about corruption, what they often meant was not so much, you know, taking bribes in exchange for favors, right? What we mean with modern corruption, they meant more a kind of entropic decay that was, in society. And that is so much of what we see in South Africa, is that the normal safeguards in the society that kind of keep that entropic decay at the bounds and even suppress it, have fallen apart, and you get the sort of corrosion of everything. You know, where you write laws that have all these visions for how, you know, like if a mining company was supposed to mine this area, right? They would have to have this environmental plan, and then they would have to restore the area to this, and then there would be this particular wage that everyone would have to be paid, and then if miners didn't do what the company wanted, or not showing up to work or not performing or something, they'd have to go through processes to fire them, all that kind of thing. And because all of that is, you know, so onerous, official companies don't do it. And then the cowboys show up, and it's just chemicals everywhere. It's just, you know, gangs killing each other. It's like, so sort of that creeping sort of corruption of just eroding everything has really crept in, I think, over so much of our society. And it's why things need to change. And, you know, we've at length in our Blueprints for Growth explained what specifically needs to change. But this story is a great example of the problems facing us.
It is. That phrase, decline and fall, comes to mind. But, you know, as you say, there are really, I mean, our whole Blueprint for Growth series of papers, which I highly recommend listeners and viewers go and have a look at on our website, it sets out what are specifically inexpensive and quite simple steps that can be taken towards what we think is an achievable ambition of a 70% growth, 7% growth rate in the 2030s.
You know, 70% would be nice.
Yeah, 70 would be wonderful. We sort of need that for a few years just to recover. But 7%. And the point being that it's not rocket science, actually. It's really quite simple things. It's, you know, a lot of these regulations are useful and important. It's really just a question of whether they are unduly onerous, and whether there's a sort of ability of the government and officials and so on to engage with miners and figure out what works, what's feasible, you know, what is going to actually benefit the country. And instead, you know, we don't have that. And while we don't have that, we also have this institutional decline and the inability of, you know, quite ordinary efforts to make sure that the law is upheld, just being dismissed and being regarded with the kind of ridicule, which is not helpful to any of us.
Indeed. All right, let's move on to our next topic. This is just from ground up, one of the latest in a series of stories about potential corruption involving the Lottery Commission. For those who don't know, the lottery is run by, or at least the sort of license is owned by the government, and they will put out a contract and companies will bid on it. And the company that gets the bid on it gets to keep some of the profits from the lottery ticket sales, but most of the lottery money is supposed to go to various charitable enterprises, you know, like building a school or an old age home or a orphanage or whatever. And a number of these projects the lottery was supposed to have invested money in to help various communities around the country have unfortunately been subject to an enormous amount of corruption, which is being investigated by the Special Investigative Unit. An old age home in Ndumbe in northern KZN is one such one. It was a 36.8 million rand old age home that is still unfinished despite being started in 2017. The contract was originally given to a dodgy company that was, I think, registered as an NGO with no previous history of construction. They didn't finish the thing because presumably they were owned by some person connected to whoever handed out the contract, is the suspicion here. And so another company was brought in to solve the problem, but now apparently they say they couldn't finish the contract either because the first company was blocking them from completing it and demanding essentially extortionate money let them have access to the building site. And now the National Lotteries Commission is suing the second company, saying that they didn't do their job right. Kind of seems like they should sue the first company, but anyway. So, complete mess. We've seen this in so many circumstances, but Michael, you said that you thought it tied nicely into what our colleagues were speaking about today at a webinar. What were your thoughts on this?
Yes, indeed. So, our colleagues, Gabriel Krauser, who's Executive Director of IRR Legal, and a fellow at the IRR, has produced a report. It's part of the Blueprint for Growth series we mentioned earlier. Cut VAT and BEE premiums. It's an updated version of an initial report produced last year. This is a new report, with new data and survey details and so on. The essential point is that a huge savings can be achieved by cutting BEE premiums and ensuring that value for money is at the center of something like more than 1 trillion. I think it's 1.4 trillion rands state procurement spending a year. That's an awful lot of money. BEE premiums muddle the choices that procurement officers make. It's not properly accounted for, not visibly accounted for. Gabriel has and his team have done a huge amount of work in getting Treasury to reveal more and more and more about where exactly these numbers are. I'd recommend going to look at those reports and look at the data. It's really quite fascinating, quite unnerving. But it's gradually the argument is building for what the Zondo Commission argued was necessary, is value for money spending, procurement spending. 1.4 trillion a year, that's a lot of money. This is going to be much better for black-owned businesses, white-owned businesses, doesn't matter. Any business in South Africa is going to benefit from an environment in which there's better competition. The society is going to obviously benefit enormously from value for money spending. The taxpayers are going to see real results for the money that they are paying in taxes and so on. I immediately saw in the story, and all credit to Ground Up for using this term, that Ubusu, the company that got the initial, I think it was 24 million, if I'm not mistaken,
yeah, 23.8 million.
Right. Okay. It is described as a dodgy shelf company. And the telling thing is this line that Ubusu, a Pretoria-based non-profit company, had no track record of undertaking or administering major infrastructure projects at the time of the first payment by the Lotteries Commission in October 2017. So that really immediately tells you that there's something strange going on. And these strange goings on are very much covered, obscured by what is perceived to be the public good of BEE premiums. And our whole, Gabriel's work on this demonstrates that it's actually not a public good, that we can benefit from scrapping them, cutting VAT, helping millions and millions of South Africans who are really struggling, burdened, you know, financially burdened households. That is a better way to go. And this, this story does bring it out very clearly. I also just want to mention this. I see the second byline on the story is Raymond Joseph, who I know has long worked for GroundUp, but he's also done enormous amount of work on following the lottery story, following the money, querying, causing a fuss. He's a great sort of veteran journalist. I've worked with him in the 90s and early 2000s. And it's great to see him still at his desk and doing this kind of work. It really is terribly important for South Africa that we understand, you know, we can see, and that good old fashioned reporting brings this material to our attention. So, yeah, I think a very significant story.
Indeed. All right, let's very briefly move on to our last story, which to me seems like pretty good news, although I'm open to anyone telling me why it's not, but it seems to me like a pretty good development. The Department of Basic Education says that it is thinking about using additional indicators to determine the success of various provincial education departments. Currently, the Basic Education Department pretty much mostly just focuses on the pass rate, the sort of raw pass rate to determine the successfulness of particular education departments in the provinces around the country. And this has created sort of slightly strange results, like, for example, KZN, which I think most people would recognize as being a province that has many, many severe challenges and problems in governance, is topping the education department's rankings of the provinces. I think the Free State in second place, and then Gauteng in the Western Cape in, I think it was third and fourth. The idea of the basic education department here is to explore a whole bunch of other mechanisms, like the throughput rate, how many kids are actually making it through to the matric in the first place, right? Because a huge number of students drop out. What the quality of maths education is, what the quality of accounting, physical science, technical maths all are. The percentage of pupils who took maths, the percentage who achieved a bachelor's pass, and the percentage who achieved distinctions will all be considered as things that will rank the various education departments and how successful they've been. Michael, this seems like something I think that actually should have been done probably a pretty long time ago. I mean, we've argued for a while that, for example, the throughput rate wasn't being talked about enough. Our maths and science education has been in a pretty bad state, and yet it's sort of kind of been pushed to the side and just chasing the goal of this ever higher pass rate. I think this is a positive development. What are your thoughts?
I do agree, yes, and I it's interesting to see Professor Rebecca Silkirk at Stellenbosch saying this is very encouraging. She talks about many unstable factors that determine a matric pass rate, and these make the standalone matric rates an unfair and unreliable measure of comparison. And it's partly that word comparison that I focus on, because one often has a sense of people are competing to get the bigger number. And the bigger number is often not the thing that you really want to be looking at. You want to be looking at the quality of the teaching, the quality of the outcomes, and maybe, recognizing, we get a kind of nominal 82% or whatever. I mean, aren't they in the 90s now, the pass rates? you know, these really high pass rate. And the risk is
90%, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and so you become complacent about the very real things that need huge attention, the actual quality of the education, the science, and I'm, you know, I'm perfectly happy to see science and mathematics, you know, given prominence. But to me, as a humanities chap, I also want to see history and English and French, and also being rated as highly. I think any education is, you know, it's worth. While needs to be pursued, but that's what we need to focus on, you know, and as long as we're looking simply at this nominal figure, we're not going to be looking at the quality of the teaching and the, you know, inspiring young people to really perform. The other point, of course, I mean, I'm always hugely impressed with young South Africans who, coming from even the poorest backgrounds, can really do, make a huge effort and very often succeed, you know, against the odds. The penalty for them is very sad. Often it's the penalty of poor teaching all the way back in their primary schools, the grounding, the sort of basic grounding in whether it's language or mathematics or science, and that's not their fault. You know, they're trying very hard. They get that 90% pass rate, but their fundamental sort of education capacity or knowledge capacity, I can't really think of the word pedagogical. No, that's not it. But their ability to, the intellectual ability, might well be undermined by something that dates all the way back to their primary years, and they can overcome it. But overcoming it might mean longer, you know, more years at university, having to do all sorts of extra courses. So there's a cost, you know. But I think, so, you know, young South Africans are really energetic and willing to succeed. And it's good that we're getting an education system that is focusing on really the things that we need to do to improve that outcome.
Indeed. Agree pretty much 100%. All right. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show informative today, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. I won't be here, but my colleagues will be running things. So I shall see you all again on Monday. Cheers, everyone. Have a great week.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.